The two helicopters flew almost side by side, with the number two only slightly behind and higher than the leader. Below them, the Irish Sea was a sheet of beaten lead, flecked with feathers of white water. They had refueled at Carnarvon and had made good time since leaving the Welsh coast, for the wind drove them on. But still, the night was overtaking them, and Peter Stride fretted, glancing at his wristwatch every few seconds. It was only 90 miles of open water to cross, but to Peter it seemed like the entire Atlantic. Collins slumped beside him on the bench that ran the length of the hold, with a cold stump of cheroot in the corner of his mouth, in deference to the no smoking light that burned on the bulkhead behind the flight deck. The rest of the Thor team had adapted their usual attitudes of complete relaxation. Some of them sprawled on the deck, using their equipment as pillows. The others stretched out full length on the benches. Peter Stride was the only one tensed up, as though his blood fizzed with nervous energy. He stood up once again to peer through the Perspex window, checking the amount of daylight and trying to judge the height and position of the sun through the thick cloud cover. "Take it easy," Colin counseled him as he dropped back into his seat. "You'll give yourself an ulcer." "Colin, we've got to decide. What are our priorities on this strike?" He had to shout above the racket of wind and motor.
"There are no priorities. We have only one object, to get Melissa Jane out and out safely.
We aren't going to try for prisoners to interrogate. Peter, baby, we are going to hit anything and everything that moves in the target area, and we are going to hit them hard." Peter nodded with satisfaction. "They'll only be goons anyway. You can be certain that their paymaster won't let them connect to him. But what about Kingston Parker? He would want prisoners."
"Kingston Parker?"
Colin removed the stub of cheroot from his mouth.
"Never heard of him. Around here it's Uncle Colin makes the decisions."
And he grinned at Peter, that friendly, lopsided grin. And at that moment the flight engineer crossed the cabin and yelled at Colin,
"Irish coast ahead. We'll be landing at Enniskerry in 7 minutes, sir."
Air traffic control at Enniskerry had been apprised of the emergency. They stacked the other traffic in holding pattern above circuit altitude and cleared the two RAF helicopters for immediate landing. They came clattering out of the low grey cloud and rain and settled on the hangar apron. Immediately a police car with headlights burning in the gloom sped out from between the hangars and parked beside the leading machine. Before the rotors had stopped turning, two members of the Irish Constabulary and a representative of the Surveyor General's office were scrambling up into the camouflage fuselage. "Stride." Peter introduced himself quickly. He was dressed now in Thor assault gear, the one-piece fitted black suit and soft boots, the pistol on its webbing belt strapped down to his right thigh.
"General, we've had a confirmation," the police inspector told him while they were still shaking hands. "Local people have identified O'Shaughnessy from a police photograph. He's staying in the area, all right."
"Have they found where?" Peter demanded.
"They have, sir. It's an old rambling building on the edge of the village."
He motioned the bespectacled surveyor to come forward with the file he was clutching to his chest. There was no chart table in the stripped-out hull of the helicopter, and they spread the survey map and photographs on the deck. Colin Noble ordered across the team from the second helicopter, and 20 men crowded into a huddle about the maps.
"There, that's the building." The surveyor placed a circle on the map with a blue pencil.
"Right," grunted Colin. "We've got good fixes. We pick up either the river on the road and follow it to the bridge and the church. The target is between them."
"Haven't we got a blow-up of the building, a plan of the interior?" one of the Thor team asked.
"Sorry, there wasn't time to do a proper search," the surveyor apologized.
"The local police reported again a few minutes ago, and we got a relay on the radio. They say the house is enclosed by a high stone wall and that there are no signs of activity."
"They haven't been near it?"
Peter demanded.
"They were strictly ordered not to approach the suspects."
"They drove past once on the public road." The inspector looked slightly abashed.
"They wanted to make certain that..."
"If it's O'Shaughnessy, he needs only one sniff and he'll be gone."
Peter's expression was stony, but his eyes sparkled blue with anger. Why can't these people do what they are told?
He turned quickly to the helicopter pilot in his yellow life jacket and helmet with its built-in microphone and earphones. Can you get us in?
The pilot did not answer immediately, but glanced up at the nearest window. A fresh gout of rain splashed against the pane.
It'll be dark in 10 minutes or even earlier, and the ceiling is down to the deck now. We only got down here using the airport VOR beacons.
He looked dubious.
There's nobody aboard who will recognize the target.
Hell, I don't know. I could get you in at first light tomorrow.
It has to be tonight, now, right now.
If you could get the local police to mark the target, the pilot suggested, with torches or a flare.
There's no chance of that. We have to go in cold, and the longer we sit here talking, the lesser our chances.
Will you give it your best shot?
Peter was almost pleading. The go decision is one that cannot be forced on a pilot. Even air traffic control cannot force a pilot in command to operate beyond his personal judgment.
We will have to try and keep ground contact all the way. It's classic conditions for trouble, rising terrain and deteriorating weather.
Try it, Peter said, please.
The pilot hesitated 5 seconds longer.
Let's go,
he said abruptly, and there was a concerted rush for the hatchway as the second Thor team made for the other machine, and the police and surveyor made certain they were not included on the passenger list. Turbulence slogged the helicopter like the punches of a heavyweight prizefighter, and she dipped and staggered to them with a nauseatingly giddy action. The ground flickered past under them, very close, and yet darkly insubstantial in the wild night. The headlights of a solitary vehicle on a lonely country road, the cluttered lights of a village, each a distinct yellow rectangle, they were so close. These were the only landmarks with any meaning. The rest was dark patches of woods, the threads of hedges, and stone walls drawn lightly across somber fields. And every few minutes, even that was gone, as a fresh squall of grey clouds and rain washed away all vision, and the pilot concentrated all his attention on the dull glow of the flight instruments arranged in their distinctive T layout in front of him. Each time they emerged from cloud, the light seemed to have diminished, and the dark menace of Earth loomed more threateningly as they were forced lower and lower to keep contact. Peter was squeezed into the jump seat of the helicopter's flight deck between the two pilots, and Colin crowded in behind him, all of them peering ahead, all silent and tense as the ungainly machines lumbered low and heavy over the earth, groping for the shoreline. They hit the coast. The ghostly white line of surf flared with phosphorescence only 50 feet below them, and the pilot swung them to run south with it, and seconds later, another brighter field of lights appeared below them.
Wicklow, said the pilot, and his co-pilot called the new heading. Now they had made a fix, they could head for Lara directly.
They swung onto the new heading, following the road inland.
4 minutes to target,
the co-pilot shouted at Peter, stabbing ahead with his finger, and Peter did not try to answer in the clatter and roar of the rotors. But he reached down and checked the Walter in its quick-release holster. It came out cleanly in his fist. Gilly O'Shaughnessy threw his few personal possessions into the blue canvas airways grip, a change of underclothing and his shaving gear. Then he pulled the iron bedstead away from the wall, ripped back the skirting board, and cleared out the hiding place he had made there by removing a single brick. There were the new papers and passports. Caliph had even provided papers for the brat, Helen Barry, his daughter. Caliph had thought of everything. With the papers was £600 sterling in traveller's cheques and a package of spare ammunition for the pistol. He thrust these into the pocket of his jacket and took one last look around the bare, bleak room. He knew that he had left nothing to lead the hunters, because he never carried anything that could be used to identify him. Yet he was obsessed by the need to destroy all sign of his passing. He had long ago ceased to think of himself by the name of Gilly O'Shaughnessy. He had no name, and only one purpose. That purpose was destruction. The magnificent passion to reduce all life to decay and mortification. He could recite by heart most of Bakunin's The Revolutionary Catechism, especially the definition of the true revolutionary. The lost man, who has no belongings, no outside interests, no personal ties of any sort, not even a name. Possessed of but one thought, interest and passion, the revolution. A man who has broken with society, broken with its laws and conventions. He must despise the opinions of others and be prepared for death and torture at any time. Hard towards himself, he must be hard to others, and in his heart there must be no place for love, friendship, gratitude, or even honour. As he stood now in the empty room, he saw himself in a rare moment of revelation as the man he had set out to become, the true revolutionary, and his head turned for a moment to indulge in the vanity of regarding his own image in the mirror, screwed to the peeling wallpaper above the iron bedstead. It was the dark, cold face of the lost man, and he felt proud to belong to that elite class, the cutting edge of the sword. That's what he was. He picked up the canvas grip and strode through into the kitchen. "Are you ready?" he called. "Help me." He dropped the grip and stepped to the window. The last of the light was fading swiftly, glowing pink and mother of pearl within the drooping, pregnant belly of the sky. It seemed so close he could reach out and touch it. Already the trees of the unkempt orchard were melding into the darkness as the night encroached. "I cannot carry her on my own," the doctor whined, and he swung away from the window. It was time to go again. In his life, there was always the moving onwards, and always the hunters baying hard upon his scent. It was time to run again, run like the fox. He went through into the second room. The doctor had the child wrapped in a grey woolen blanket, and he had tried to lift her from the bed, but had failed. She was sprawled awkwardly half onto the floor. "Help me," repeated the doctor. "Get out of the way." Gilly O'Shaughnessy pushed him roughly aside and stooped over the girl. For a second, their faces were within inches of each other. Her eyes were opened, half conscious, although the pupils were widely dilated by the drug. The lids were pink-rimmed, and there were little butter-yellow lumps of mucus in the corners. Her lips were dried to white scales and cracked through to the raw flesh at three places. "Please tell my daddy," she whispered. "Please tell him I'm here." His nostrils flared at the sick, sour smell of her body, but he picked her up easily with an arm under her knees and the other under her shoulders and carried her out across the kitchen, kicking open the door so the lock burst and it slammed back against its hinges. Quickly he carried her across the yard to the garage, with the doctor staggering along after them, carrying a carton of medical supplies and equipment against his chest, cursing miserably at the cold and sliding and slipping in the treacherous footing. Gilly O'Shaughnessy waited while the doctor opened the rear door of the car, and then he bundled her in so roughly that the child cried out weakly. He ignored her and went to the double garage doors and dragged them open. It was so dark now that he could not see as far as the bridge. "Where are we going?" bleated the doctor. "I haven't decided yet," Gilly told him brusquely. "There is a safe house up north, or we might go back across the sea to England." He thought of the caravan again. That was a good one. "But why are we leaving now, so suddenly?" He didn't bother to reply, but left the garage and ran back into the kitchen. Always he was so obsessed by the need to cover his tracks, to leave no sign for the hunters. Though he had brought little with him and was taking that now, yet he knew the old house contained signs, even if it was only his fingerprints. There was also the single remaining appetite for destruction to assuage.